You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter in a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. Hey, it's March, and I'm saying that already. Aren't I a little early?
Isn't it spectacular out there? We're recording this program on Wednesday, March 16th, for broadcast on Thursday, March 17th, 2022. And the temperature right now is 64 degrees with a humidity of 55%, going up to a high today of 71 degrees. And some north winds picking up at the moment, and going to have some changes. We had a little rain, a little, and that's the operative word, a little rain. Most people recorded a tenth of an inch, maybe 2/20 hundredths of an inch. And all that really did was clean off some leaves and cause the dust to fall down from above and land on our cars. And what it also did was it broke the string of days without measurable rainfall in Sacramento. I don't even have it in front of me, but it was something like 62 days straight without rainfall. No, it did not recharge the water tables or add measurably to the water supplies, but it was a nice change of pace. And it did clean things up a little bit, and the plants certainly seemed to appreciate it. And then we've got a very interesting pattern to the weather for the next few days. All right, March 16th. Tonight's low is going to be 45 degrees. That's great. I can leave some of those seedlings outside, not worry so much about rushing them back in, you know, before the end of the day, because it's not going to be freezing. That's good. Gradual clearing on Thursday, the day of the broadcast, 68 degrees. And Thursday night, mostly clear and some patchy fog. Okay, let's throw that into the weather mix. Dropping down to
fog? We don't have fog here. What are you talking about?
Yeah, we're back to fog. So this is back to the winter thing. We're having all three seasons in 2 weeks, because I'm not done yet. Patchy fog, 41 degrees. Oop, a little chilly. Friday, patchy fog, mostly sunny, 71 degrees. That sounds lovely. Friday night, chance of rain. Saturday, rain. They're just saying rain, 80%, but the whole thing seems to be rain. Now, it's not a big storm, but it's going to rain on Saturday. It should be about another 2/10 of an inch. And then Saturday night is only going to be 42 degrees with a chance of showers and partly cloudy. Sunny Sunday and breezy, 66 degrees. Here's where we get a little funny. Sunday night, 45. Monday, sunny with a high near 75. Warming. Monday night, 51. It's Tuesday, 81 degrees.
What?
81 degrees. And let's jump over to Weather Underground, because they always go a little further out on their 10-day forecast. They get really specific. Weather Underground, wonderground.com, as that you will find them online, is telling us that on Tuesday, March 22nd, it's going to be 87 degrees.
Don,
don't blame me. I'm not in charge of this.
Okay. But is that real? Or are we, I mean, is that like a one-time blip? Or is it like...
It's a two-day blip. It's a two-day blip. It's going to be, according to them, 87 on Tuesday. We'll see. And then Tuesday night, 52. Wednesday, 86. Wednesday night, 51. And then cooling. Thursday is only going to be 82. 82. We're in March. 50 degrees at night, then dropping rapidly on Friday down to 77 and cooling back off. As a retailer, I can tell you it's going to be a confusing week, because we'll have people walking in shirt sleeves talking about how hot it is and wondering why the place is not overflowing with summer vegetables. And I assure you, many of us will bring in a fair number of summer vegetables for you to start gathering, start purchasing, start collecting, putting them in a nice sheltered place near your house and getting ready for planting them in about a month or so. We don't put these in the ground until a little bit later. We've talked about all the various parameters, you know, soil temperature, nighttime temperatures. Well, this, you know, I do say 80s by day, we're going to be there. 50s at night, we're going to be there for a couple of days. The soil temperature will push back up. People will start to stretch the season. Everybody's really concerned about last year's, the perceived heat that we had, and they're concerned that they will have to get planted early. I don't think the high temperatures were your big issue last year. I think watering was your big issue last year. But again, when we have these days in the 80s, people want to plant. If I were going to look at the available summer vegetables and foods and flowers and things and assess which ones could safely go in the ground without significant adverse consequence, probably, I would say tomatoes could, if you're prepared to cover them over with something to make that soil warmer, if we cool down again, which it looks like we will. They may be set back by colder temperatures, but they are vigorous plants and will probably recover. I will emphasize, I don't think you're gaining anything when you do this. I do think you're asking for blossom end rot when you do this, because when the plants get going, when they flower, when they set, and then we get somewhat colder than average temperatures, or even really relatively close to average temperatures, internal problems in the plant lead to that phenomenon known as blossom end rot on the first fruit that sets. And that's true of tomatoes especially, but it's also true of peppers and squash and certain other summer vegetables. So a lot of times you go to all this work to plant early thinking you're going to beat the season, get the first fruit, and then as it's ripening, you look on the bottom and it's gotten mushy, and that is the classic blossom end rot. As we've said many times, this is not a calcium deficiency. It's not something you can correct with a soil additive. There's nothing you can add at the time of planting that'll reduce it. It's primarily appears to be almost entirely related to soil temperature and moisture. So if you water when the soil is cold and the plant is developing, the fruit is in the expansion phase, it appears to be the major factor in the development of blossom end rot. No, it's not a disease. It's not something you can spray for, and there's no product, despite what many nurseries may try to tell you, that's going to prevent this. It's just a consequence of early planting. Now, before we go too far off on that, we'll come back to this because there's plenty to talk about, but that would be the one drawback. However, of all the summer vegetables that I can think of, all the summer vegetables that I can think of, the one that is best able to recover from the adverse consequences of planting when the soil is too cold is probably a vigorous indeterminate tomato vine. It'll be set back by cold temperatures if we get them, but then it'll regrow. So on the other hand, if you plant your peppers, your eggplant too early, and I've done this many times, planted early, mid-season and late, the early planted ones always underperform the others because they're stunted by having been put in the ground too early. So if you got to get something in the ground, go ahead and buy some tomatoes. My best suggestion would be, as I've said several times now, almost every day, go ahead and get the bed ready. Pull the weeds out, cover them over if that's what you're going to do to kill them. Put some mulch down, put some compost on the bed, give it a good soaking, put your drip system or soaker system in, check that out, make sure it's running well, and then be patient and wait for either the soil to warm up or the nights to warm up before you go ahead and plant. Starting in the third week of April is our recommendation, going into May, and May is our very active planting month for all those summer vegetables.
So that's depressing.
No, it's cheerful. We're getting an early start.
No. What can I plant now safely?
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't have to be a tomato. It doesn't have to be any of those tropical things. Don't you have some flowers I can stick in the ground?
Yes, that's a great idea. Plant some flowers, because there's lots of flowers that garden centers have. And we still have some of the cool season things that will continue to bloom, like violas and snapdragons. And a lot of us are bringing in young seedlings of the summer flowering flowers as well. Now, some of those really need heat. I'll have an article in the Davis Enterprise this coming weekend. I think they're going to run it, which I'm talking about zinnias and sunflowers and some of the things that are easy to grow for flowers from seed. But we don't plant them yet. It's running now, so people will start thinking about it and planning it now. They're much like tomatoes. They want to go into warm soil. But there are other things, marigolds, pinks, you know, the dianthus, they can go into soil that's cool. They aren't nearly as adversely affected as the real heat lovers like zinnias are. And sunflowers are surprisingly tolerant. Almost anybody who has a bird feeder has had the experience of watching sunflowers sprout under the bird feeder during sunny spells as early as late January or into February. They're surprisingly tolerant of cold and even a little bit of frost. So yes, there are some flowers you could put in now. You could get ready for the summer vegetables. And many of us still do have some of the cool season things. Now it's getting late for, you know, I don't want you going out and buying broccoli, cauliflower, things like that. But many people continue planting leafy greens, the spinach, the kale, it's trying to flower, but you can eat it while it's flowering. Lettuce, things like that can be planted for a few more weeks of harvest. But once we start getting into the 80s, the quality of those vegetables is going to diminish pretty rapidly. So it's a challenging time for garden centers. One of the reasons so many places that sell plants fill up their shelves with vegetables at this time of year is that it's really too late for us to reasonably sell you cool season stuff. And while it's too early for the warm season stuff, people will buy it. You know, you put it out there in February, people will buy it. And many of these places don't have these, let's just say, rigorous standards for exactly what is the optimal planting conditions for the things they're selling. I prefer not to sell people things that aren't going to do well, so I hold off. But I can tell you, when I'm answering the same question day after day and people are obviously champing at the bit, we'll go ahead and bring things in just like other places will, and we'll put a sign up right over them. We do this every year. It's really fun. Right over the tomatoes, it says, it's too early to plant these in the ground. And you watch the couples go up to them, and the one spouse is looking down at the vegetables and wondering which ones to get, and the other one is reading the sign. Hey, it says here, it's too early to put these in the ground. And they come up to the counter, they go, you're selling these now, but it's too early to put them in the ground. And we have the same conversation you and I just had. Okay.
So what about bulbs? Can I do bulbs still?
Say what?
Can I plant bulbs now?
Bulbs. There are bulbs you should have planted in the fall. Mm-hmm. You find some in your refrigerator or something? Because we had a call like that. I just found the tulips that I put in the refrigerator. What should I do with them? And the answer is plant. And put them in the ground. They'll flower. It'll be kind of funny. They'll be a little bit late. It's the beginning of when we start planting gladiolus, if people still do that. That's really fallen off in popularity. Dahlias, a little bit later on, the caladiums and things will come in. So these are the spring planted. We call them bulbs, although most of them aren't technically true bulbs. Planted in the spring to late spring or early summer for their summer bloom. And some of those are coming in. My dahlias are in a truck somewhere between here and Indiana. Yeah, I expect them to arrive any day. So that's the kind of thing you can start thinking about now as well. Yes, there are flowers. I mean, one of the things we're doing at our garden center this year is we're going in a big way for seedlings of flowers for cutting. Things like the zinnias that are long stem, big zinnias, the cosmos, cornflower. We've got bachelor's buttons going. We're doing all those kinds of things. You can do them at home if you're listening in USDA zone 9 or 10, possibly zone 8. You should check locally. You can start these now indoors if that's more appropriate to your climate. Some of these are very easy from seed. You can move them out as soon as your weather permits and start planting them out in the garden. So these are things that will give you lots of bloom throughout the course of the summer. I'm doing them because these are the kinds of flowering plants it's very hard for me to get from growers. And so I just think people want them. I think people want the foxgloves and the delphiniums and the old-fashioned flowers like that. And for me to get them at this point, I pretty much have to grow my own. That means you can too. I mean, if you're pretty good at starting things from seed or want to give it a try, you can't go wrong with sunflowers from seed. They're really surprisingly easy. And it's a great project with kids. It's actually easier to do them in pots than out in the ground. A little side detour here, because out in the ground, you might as well just call all the local squirrels and birds and say, come on over. I just put some food in the ground. Go ahead and dig them up and eat those seeds. Whereas if you start them in pots and plant them out, you can protect them and monitor them and do whatever is necessary. But it is fun and easy to do. And, you know, sunflowers are inexpensive. The seed is easy to grow and you can go ahead and start that now. So there are flowers you can plant now and you can continue planting kitchen herbs and things like that. But the main thing would be, if you're listening in USDA zone 9, sunset zones 8, 9, 14, it's time to start planning, but it's not yet time to start planting in your vegetable garden. We have a couple of those PSAs that we like to do, and this is an important one. There's an event that's gone on in Davis now since 2004. Retiring County Supervisor Don Saylor, who's also been a city council member and on the Board of Education, has been running a Soups On event, where all kinds of people come together and have a bowl of soup and make a contribution. And he chooses a particular worthy cause in Yolo County for the revenues. And since 2004, the Soups On event has raised over $300,000. Well, this is the final year. Don is retiring. And not me, Don Saylor is retiring. Soups On will benefit Davis Media Access. Yeah, there's the silent auction, all kinds of other stuff there. There will be the live music of noted local group Mumbo Gumbo, and Soups On is building on the tradition that we gather as a community to enjoy a hearty bowl of warm soup during the cool season and when someone is in need. And each year it brings together 400 people from the community and organizations to share a meal, jointly support a worthy nonprofit with 100% of the proceeds of the event going to support that selected nonprofit. And it's us, Davis Media Access, the organization that is the parent to KDRT. It's a volunteer-run event, so mark your calendar Thursday, April 21, 6 to 8 p.m. It'll be held at the Veterans Memorial Center, including a bowl of donated soup for each attendee. There'll be the live music, a silent auction, a celebration of the good work provided by Davis Media Access and the past recipients throughout Yolo County. We'd love to see you there. We'd love to have your help. And at any event, come on down and get a bowl of soup and help contribute to KDRT directly by contributing to Davis Media Access. There will be the usual safety precautions. So you can simply go to donsaylor.org, S-A-Y-L-O-R, donsaylor.org/soupson, and read all about the Soups on Davis Media Access supporting event on April 21st of this year.
We talked a lot about weather, yes, and whether or not it's a good time to plant, or whether or not you have to turn off your sprinklers or turn on your sprinklers. So how about a review of what happened last year? I know you did an article in the Davis Enterprise, I think it was in February. It says, how did your garden grow? And it talked about it was a difficult summer, and why was that? So do you want to review a little bit of that?
Yeah. We talked a couple of weeks ago. We went over this article in some detail, but I just want to briefly mention, because people are thinking about last year as they're planning for this year, and they're concerned about temperatures and things like that. And in my opinion, in a nutshell, the main problem we had with vegetable gardens and fruit trees to some degree was the extraordinary drought. Less than 7 inches of rain, depending on where you were, Davis to Woodland, 6 to 7 inches of rain for the total rainfall year. Now, those of you listening in other areas should know our average rainfall here is 18, 19 inches. And we normally, average year, we get rainfall starting in October and November, December, January, February, we should get as much as 3 inches or more per month. And then March, a couple inches, and April, even an inch or two, and sometimes some rain in May. None of that happened. We got 6 inches, 7 inches total, and the season started with very, very dry soil. That can actually affect production of fruit trees significantly, which has been an interesting conversation with people because it's wildly variable as to how it affects them. And it had a big effect, in my opinion, on how the vegetable gardens got off to, what kind of start they got off to, I guess is the best way to put it. People were watering their normal way, and that wasn't enough. Because you would dig down there to plant your tomato, and even if you'd watered, you know, enough to penetrate 8 to 12 inches, you could plant the plant, but below that was bone dry soil. And we're starting this year with soil that's dry in the top foot, foot and a half. And I only know this because I've been doing some augering and digging on my farm, and there's moisture down there. It's down the foot to 2 feet down from the rains that we last had in, what was it, January, December, but the top is dry. And so thoroughly irrigating the whole bed before you go in to plant your vegetables is going to be important. Watering very deeply at first is going to be important. It's not as bad as last year. My guess is most people will have better results this year. If you have generally good results with your previous irrigation, it'll probably work again this year, but it didn't work last year. And part of that was that those tomatoes just couldn't get their roots down. And tomatoes in particular, they're the big thing everybody grows. And we had variable results with other vegetables, but people could accommodate for that. If they saw the peppers and eggplant, which are pretty shallow rooted, weren't doing as well as they thought they should, they could just up the frequency. But tomatoes, one of the big things that makes them work here is that we have deep, rich agricultural soil in this area. Even in the areas where it's high density, it's deep and roots can go down and out quite extensively, but not if it's dry. They cannot grow into dry soil. So we're starting dry. It's not as bad as last year, but it is dry. So when you do plant, water at least that first time really, really, really thoroughly. I mean, hydrate the whole zone. Then if you've had an effective watering regimen before, you can go back to that, but let the plant tell you. And also, this is really important, poke around in there. You know, take that 18-inch screwdriver that you all have now because if you've been listening to the Davis Garden Show, or a good long trowel and start poking around. After you irrigate, I like to go out the next day with a trowel and dig around the plant and see if the moisture got down, and then dig around a foot or so out from the plant and see if the moisture got out and down, and make sure that's happening. It might be as simple as adding another drip emitter. It might be as simple as increasing your duration by 10 or 20%, just to water a little deeper and a little wider. I'm particularly concerned about the inline emitter systems like Netafim, where they have a relatively low output because people tend not to run them long enough. If you're running those, they need to run an hour plus, an hour and a half to give an inch of water. And most people don't do that. So intermittently doing long irrigations, increasing how long it runs each time, or more important, checking your soil. Because I know we've got people listening who are in areas with heavy soil. We've got people listening with raised planters. We've got people listening with sandy soil. Your answer is going to be site dependent. So you're going to have to go by what is appropriate to your soil. In a raised planter, for example, especially in its first year when you brought in all this fancy stuff, it's very common to need to water daily. And people are aghast at that, but you don't have to water a really long time daily, but it's a fancy, fluffy, light, fast draining soil sitting perched up on top of heavier soil down below. That's a challenge for roots. And so you just have to keep watering frequently. And people who I know who have built raised planters, filled them with purchased topsoil that's been amended for that purpose from a rock yard or something like that, typically find from about May through the season, they need to run that system almost every day, long enough to water to a depth of a foot or so. When I've added up what they're doing and compared it to what I'm doing, it's not a huge difference in the total amount of water. It's just that I can put on, because I've got like silty loam on my farm out here, I can put it all on at once. I can water a tomato very deeply all at once, water to a depth of a couple of feet. If you're in a raised planter, it just drains out too fast. So as we've said many times before, you'll have to water more frequently in a raised planter. If you're trying to conserve mulch, that makes a big difference. Put any kind of mulch on the surface after you plant. You don't need to incorporate anything in when you plant necessarily, but mulching after the planting, as we get into the hot weather, can make a big difference with respect to water retention. But also check your system and what it's actually doing. Because a lot of people last year were coming in, they were giving up on their tomatoes, maybe running their drip system for 10 minutes, 15 minutes, nowhere near enough. One of the common ones we heard is 20 minutes three times a week, which is about a third of what those plants probably needed. So longer irrigations, intermittently upping how long it runs, whatever works for your particular irrigation system, your particular soil type, and whatever the restrictions are wherever you're listening, because some municipalities are going to have water use restrictions. Typically, they'll say irrigate 3 days a week. Okay, that works. That'll work for almost any soil if you do run it long enough and you can do some calculation. If you've got questions about that, your particular soil type, your particular irrigation system, give us the details, send them to davisgardenshow@gmail.com, because your situation is probably pretty similar to some other listeners. And we'd be happy to talk about how to adjust what we've just said, customize it, shall we say, customize it to your particular garden situation.
So I have a question for you. You said that you were digging around with an auger in your farm, and that's how you figured out that there was a foot and a half of dry soil, and then below that there was water, there was a wet, moist soil. So if I don't have an auger, and I can I just, you know, go to a spot that doesn't have a plant in and dig a hole when I can find out that?
Well, yeah, first of all, doing that and finding it's hard to dig the hole is the first way people realize it, because it's really hard to dig a hole in dry soil. So if you go to a spot, people are coming in buying trees, a lot of landscape planting going on right now. And I'm beginning to make the suggestion that I would usually make a little later in the season, because ordinarily we'd have adequate soil moisture, and right now the top is dry. Go home and water that spot the day before you plan to plant the tree, or better yet, take a shovel out there and see if you can dig a hole. And that'll explain what we've just talked about, that the top is dry, it's hard for the shovel to get into it. I'll often go out and just excavate a little basin and then just fill it with water a couple times, then go away and let that water redistribute by capillary action. And I'll fill it up maybe once more. And usually in my soil, I can go the next day and start digging a hole without any problem. If it's really heavy, you might have to wait another day because it'll stick to your shovel. If it's really sandy, you should be able to dig right away. But it will probably need to be hydrated, just at least the top few inches in order to get the process going. And if you start to dig a hole to plant a tree and it's too dry down there, set the tree aside, fill that hole with water, wait a day or two, go do some more excavation, because you'll find that soaking it makes a huge difference about, obviously, as to how workable the soil is.
Okay, so assuming that one has found out that their soil is dry for the top 18 inches and then it's got moisture under it. Now, if I don't have an 18-inch screwdriver, I've only got a 12-inch screwdriver. And so here I am, I'm going up, it's not going in, it's too dry. So I water until it goes in. So now I've watered until I can get that all the way down. That's 12 inches deep. Yep. That means there's 6 inches of dryness. There's a layer There's moist on the top and then a layer of dry and then moist underneath. If I planted into that top, if I put my tomatoes in, their roots are 12 inches deep right now. So, but I plant my tomato and it goes down and it hits that dry layer. Is it going to stop growing down?
Yes, and that's exactly what happened, I think, to lots of gardeners last year, is that the roots could not penetrate in the seedling stage, and they ended up with a tomato that had a root zone as big as a pepper or a much smaller plant. So that illustrates it perfectly. However, you can plant, once you've got it workable around the root zone, you can go ahead and plant. Give that a good soaking. That'll go a little deeper and a little further. The roots will go into the moist soil and continue to do so. And we do know, by the way, that soil mycorrhiza, so if you've got healthy soil where you've been using cover crops and things like that, soil mycorrhiza will redistribute moisture from one area to another. Capillary action will redistribute moisture. So you don't have to fill that one hole all the time. You just have to start getting better penetration of moisture throughout the whole bed. And that generally just means running it longer at intervals. I do want to emphasize, though, a vegetable garden is a high water using part of your landscape. We say this all the time, and people seem disturbed by it, and they want to know ways to reduce water in their vegetable garden. And my answer is reduce water somewhere else or grow fewer vegetables. I know those aren't particularly popular answers, but a plant that you put in for the purpose of growing food, if it's stressed, won't produce as much food. I mean, it's that simple. So the deeper soakings are important to your vegetable garden. The frequency of watering is important to your vegetable garden. You can reduce irrigation as the season goes along with tomatoes. Many of us have been doing this for years. Water deeper and less often, deeper and less often as the plants go along. But the deeper part is an important part of that. And just keep in mind that your vegetable garden does need, on a square foot basis, about as much water as your lawn. But that's only, how big is your vegetable garden? 10 by 10? I mean, yours is a big container, right? Yeah, so you're not using that much water, and you're doing it for a purpose. You're doing it for the purpose of having a better diet, or food security, or whatever reason you have for growing vegetables. So they do deserve, I shall say, I'll go out on a limb. Your vegetables deserve more water. Maybe your lawn doesn't deserve as much water. How's that? Make these trade-offs.
Okay. We talked a few weeks ago about planting seeds and growing your own seedlings and that sort of thing. I don't think we need to go over that again, but can you just remind us the timing for growing from seed in a little seedling tray, tomatoes, peppers, and eggplants?
We are at our nursery right now starting seeds of a great many varieties of tomatoes that we plan to sell in late April and May. So it's mid-March, and we'll have them germinated in 5 to 7 days. They'll be shifted into 3-inch pots within a week or two after that. And with the warm weather they're talking about, they'll grow very rapidly. So those of you that have held off and have had all your friends and neighbors starting their tomatoes and things and feel like you're getting behind, no, you're fine. That they grow very fast. It's the peppers and eggplant in particular that take a very long time to get to a saleable or plantable size. And having gone through the process this year of planting a lot of flats of interesting peppers with the intention of selling them, and having a sudden cold snap, what was it, 3 weeks ago, where we got down to 27 degrees, and all of those 42 plus flats of peppers needed to be protected, and hauling them all into my son's bedroom every night to make sure that they were adequately protected, even leaving them indoors at times, which is not optimal. I can tell you that they're more of a hassle. So unless you're really into unusual, unique, strange, super hot, whatever peppers that you can't get at a garden center, probably if I were spending my time and effort on starting things from seed, I would buy peppers and I would start tomatoes, because you can do tomatoes as late as the 1st of April and still have plants that are perfectly healthy to plant in May and get good results with that. We're also starting a lot of seeds right now of summer flowers, as I mentioned at the start of the program. So it's a any time from late January into May is great for starting things from seed. With experience, you'll learn which things sprout quickly and which things take a long time to germinate. Tomatoes come up in literally 4 to 5 days from seed on a warm bench in our upstairs, the germination area. Peppers, even under ideal conditions, can take as much as 3 weeks. Yeah, that's it. Sunflowers, literally 3 days on a warm bench. I mean, that's how fast they come up. Squash, melons, cucumbers. Most of those squash plants that you see at a hardware store or garden center were probably seeded 4 to 5 weeks prior to your seeing them there. That's how quickly they go. So even without a greenhouse, even with just home garden conditions, some things are easy and fast from seed, and you still have plenty of time for those. A few of them, like the peppers, like the eggplant, just grow so slowly, and they also stall. They come up, they just sort of sit there waiting for better conditions or whatever, that they can be sort of frustrating to home gardeners who don't happen to have a greenhouse, don't happen to have a bright place indoors to start the plants. Starting things from seed we've talked about this more than once. Your indoor environment is not optimal for seedling growth. It can be perfect for seed germination. It's warm, temperatures are even, they don't go up and down a whole lot. The top of your refrigerator may stay 70 degrees around the clock, and that would be great for germination. It's when the seedlings come up that you've got the problem with them sprawling towards light, getting very leggy, trying to, growing, trying to grow in light that is about, by my estimation, 1/8 of what it is outside in terms of light input. And so we talk about this process of moving them in and out or putting grow lights over them, getting the air movement to help thicken the stem. Your house is not a great place to start seeds, but it can be a fun project. It's just that some things do take literally 10 to 12 weeks or more to go from seed to transplant. So focus on the things that are faster and try to find that one place around your house that's bright and sunny for some part of the day, preferably the morning. Shade of a high tree that's a deciduous tree that's slowly leafing out can be great. Good air movement, but not gale force winds. And be prepared to move those flats back inside at night if the nights are dropping below 45 degrees. I was asked for a rule of thumb. So my rule of thumb is 45 degrees. If it's getting below that, they need to come back in or else their roots are being injured. And go through that process. You'll begin to see why a lot of people start their vegetable gardens with a shopping trip at the garden center.
So we have some topics for today, and one is mycorrhiza, and you're going to tell me about the effectiveness of mycorrhiza. Now the question is, what do you think about adding mycorrhiza to the soil around a tree? And my question is, what's mycorrhiza anyway?
Those are very important organisms that live on or in endo or ecto parasites, I guess, technically. And they live on the root system of a plant and they expand massively the available surface area of the root to take in moisture and nutrients. Mycorrhizae were just being understood when I was a student in soil science. And in the 1990s, a whole lot of research was done. They found there's a whole lot of species that are living and coexisting with woody plants, grass plants, different kinds with different kinds of plants, different kinds in different regions. And they're very, very important in a lot of ways. They actually, as I said earlier, they help draw moisture into an area from nearby. One of the key things that they do is they help the roots take up certain nutrients. And anything that suppresses mycorrhiza can actually lead to micronutrient or even sometimes macronutrient deficiencies in plants because the plants are only relying on their own roots, not on this great, enormous volume of soil mycorrhizae. We now know they're incredibly important. So, when that research came along in the 1990s, I was helping to organize seminars for the Nursery Association, landscape contractors, and especially for the arborists, all of whom need continuing education. And there are lots of seminars on this topic. At the same time, there were lots of products coming on the market because of this research. People were coming out to these trade shows and hawking all of these powders and liquids and things you were supposed to put in around the roots of the plant when you put it in the ground because it needed those mycorrhizae. To which the simple research answer is probably not. They probably don't need them. If they do, there's something wrong with your soil. So the best answer I've heard from microbiologists is they're in the soil. So I'm not sure why people are talking about adding them. If they're not in the soil, good question as to whether adding them will work. And these are what it really comes down to, is whether the research that shows the importance of mycorrhiza leads logically to the need to apply mycorrhiza. And this gets into the Dr. Linda Chalker-Scott maxim that I like to repeat as often as possible. Hold on here. Is it necessary? Is it harmful? Two questions to ask about any product or practice that's being promoted to you. Putting a Tums plant under your tomato for the calcium that's in it, is it necessary? No. Is it harmful? No. So, do you need to argue with great Aunt Rhoda about her Tums tablet under the tomato plant? No, let her do it. It's absolutely fine. Mycorrhiza additions are almost certainly not necessary. If you have anything resembling normal soil, they're present. And the ones that are appropriate to your region are present. So adding them around the roots of a plant that you're putting in doesn't really make sense. Now, when I've discussed this online with fellow nursery owners who like to sell mycorrhizal products, they'll say, "Oh, well, you don't understand. In our area, the soils have just been destroyed during development." It's possible that soils have been significantly harmed during the process of subdividing a neighborhood and scraping off this and adding that and whatnot, but they regrow. The damage to soil microorganisms is not permanent. And once the conditions are favorable for them, they will come back to the previous equilibrium. Probably the simplest thing you can do to encourage anything like that is just keep top dressing the area with mulch of some sort. Get some organic material up on the surface, breaking down steadily, working its way into the soil, and providing substrate for some of these because that's what they typically need. So these are fungus that associate themselves with the roots of plants. And it's good for the fungus because they get the carbohydrates from the tree, and the tree gets the access to increased nutrients and water from the fungi. I just read that from a particular research review. There are hundreds of them. They associate with different trees in different ways. And so you don't know exactly which mycorrhiza to use for your particular one. The companies say, "Oh, we found the ones that work best for this." You know, there's a lot of evidence that that's not really accurate. Let's put it that way. Jim Downer was farm advisor at UC Extension down in Southern California, and his comment, I think, is really classic. "Some of the most convincing products are those that have solid scientific basis for efficacy, but no direct evidence that they work.
What?
A classic example is mycorrhizal inoculants for landscape trees. Very elegant research," he says, "has shown the necessity of mycorrhiza for proper growth and development for many plant and tree species. This does not indicate that those organisms are lacking from the soils, or that the products that are being sold would add them in any way, or that those products are even viable. You're taking a fungus and putting it in a bag and selling it. Well, you know, they dry out and stuff goes wrong." And in a study of 10 commercial mycorrhizal products, one researcher found that four of them failed to even infect the bioassay plants. In a second trial, three of them failed to infect at all. So they found varying growth responses, varying efficacy on these. And really, there's a lot of question about whether the products meet any kind of need that the plant has and whether any of the claims are actually valid. I don't think it hurts. But anybody who's telling you that they're absolutely necessary is probably listening to a sales rep. How's that?
Yeah.
We got them. We don't need to add them. If you do need to add them, something's wrong with your soil, so you might want to deal with that. And the way to deal with that is typically to just have a nice steady supply of organic material naturally incorporating itself into the soil. Leaves on the soil that you leave there when they fall off the tree. Pine needles are fine. Redwood needles are fine. If you don't have those things, arborist wood chips that you have dropped in your driveway and spread those out. They know. That's a really good example. Arborist wood chips from the chip drop program, where a tree service will just drop like 15 yards of them in your driveway. And you then spend the morning moving those 80 wheelbarrow loads around your yard. As soon as moist arborist wood chips are put on the surface of normal soil, earthworms and mycorrhiza move right up into them. And back and up and back, and start incorporating them naturally at a rate that is related to the temperature and moisture of the soil where you are. Incorporating them can be a problem because then you're taking basically cellulose, shavings and stuff like that, and incorporating it. That will tie up nitrogen in that root zone for a while. But just on the surface, it does it at the rate in which the worms and the organisms intend it to. So that's the simplest thing you can do to create a healthier root environment for trees. Additives, so far in the course of my career, everything that's been recommended for adding to a hole for a tree has been debunked. That goes for organic material, fertilizer, adding it to the hole, fine if you want to, but you might as well just put it on the surface. Soil mycorrhiza, all of the hormone products like Super Thrive, which as far as we know does absolutely nothing whatsoever. All of these things have this one by one. I know I get the instinct that we want to add something to make it grow better. We want to give it that little added oomph, but none of those have been shown to be particularly effective.
So one of the things I was thinking about as you were talking is there are so many different kinds of mycorrhiza and that they would probably be adapted to live wherever it is that they currently live. And so if I took one from, let's say, a jungle and I put it, let's say, in a desert It probably wouldn't survive because it's a different climate or whatever. And if I have soil that doesn't have much in it, it's probably because not much is going to grow in it.
The habitat is not suitable for it. And actually, in an interesting conversation, Robert Couric, who wrote the book on roots that we talked about a number of years ago, really good book on the topic, and he explores this kind of thing, made the comment that one researcher actually found that if you add certain mycorrhizae, they can outcompete the existing ones. That wouldn't be particularly desirable, but you get at one of the main problems here with mycorrhizae. They understand that the populations are diverse, that different fungus inhabit different geographies, different soil geographies, even. And urbanization does change the composition of the populations in a landscape, and there can be factors, but the understanding is that mycorrhizae that are not native to a site may not function at that site because they are not adapted to grow there, which is a scientist's way of saying what you just said. It calls into question the use of just any old mycorrhizal inoculant to stimulate tree growth. Is probably not going to be effective. So this is in the does it is it necessary? No. Is it harmful? Probably not. Are you wasting your money? You might be. There's certainly going to be ongoing research on this. People who believe in them really believe in them. Certainly, if you're buying these products, give them a try. It's very difficult to do research on roots of trees. You got to plant them and wait a long time, then dig them back up and kill the tree to look at what happened, which is exactly how they concluded that adding organic material did not make for a better root system for a tree. It actually made for a worse root system for a tree. So that was a lot of research over many years to come to that conclusion. So I do fully expect that there'll be continued research on mycorrhiza, perhaps getting more granular about which ones work for what, and trying to figure out a way to keep those in a package alive so that you could put it in the soil. But it really calls into the fundamental question, are they necessary? And they probably are not.
This whole thing has resonance with me because of the blueberries. Because I always heard, I grew up in blueberry country. I always heard that if you were going to move a blueberry plant from, that patch and you wanted to grow it in your yard, that you had to take some of the soil with it because there were things in the soil that were helping the blueberry to grow. And now that I'm an adult and I hear that, I think, oh, mycorrhiza. And I'm wondering if maybe there are a few specific instances where washing off the roots and planting it in a new place would set it back compared to keeping it in the soil that it was in where it was.
Well, plant pathologists can tell you that even washing them off, you're not getting all of them off. And one of the problems with moving soil, as you're describing, is that you may be moving things other than just the mycorrhizae. You may be moving undesirable soil pathogens. That's certainly possible. One interesting side note on that is that acid-loving plants, which is what blueberries are the ones where I remember when the research was first done and the products were first coming to market, they had a lot of difficulty coming up with products for azaleas, camellias, rhododendrons, blueberries. For whatever reason, it wasn't particularly challenging to find the right mix of mycorrhiza and figure out a way to package them and have you apply them. And this is one of the biggest problems, is how do you take something that's so sensitive to drying out and put it in a bag and send it to a garden center to put on the shelf to then sell to you? And say, here, you have many gabillions of microbes in here. Hopefully, some of them are still alive, and they'll probably colonize your roots if you get them in the general vicinity. You are correct. The blueberries would probably have very specific mycorrhizal associations, and that moving that soil, from one part of your yard to another was probably perhaps even beneficial. But it would be very challenging to make the leap from that to, therefore, you should add this at the time of planting blueberries. And we do know that a lot of the problems with blueberries and other plants like that have to do with taking them and putting them in very, very different kind of soil. You take an azalea or a blueberry, which does not grow in a mineral valley floor soil like the Sacramento Valley typically has, and you plant it here, they just struggle. And it could certainly be that the root systems aren't establishing, and it could certainly be that the mycorrhizae on their roots that they need, the particular ones they need, are not establishing. The question is whether there's any way you could apply them. And in the long run, we get back to the simplest thing, which is they have fine roots. They have roots that go extensively out from where the plant is. And the thing that will encourage that is even moisture. And the thing that will encourage even moisture is mulch.
And the only plants that I ever heard that about were blueberries and huckleberries. Huckleberries are a variation very similar to blueberries. I've never heard it about Any other cane berries or any other thing. The only ones I've ever heard were blueberries and huckleberries.
A long time we didn't grow blueberries here in the valley at all because they were described as acid loving and the pH of our water is high. We have alkaline water, which leads to rather alkaline soil. I'm coming to the conclusion over time that a lot of what we were attributing to pH was actually related to the plant's ability to take up nutrients and the density of the soil and other factors. It wasn't specifically the actual pH. People are doing great with blueberries now here in the valley. We're growing the kind that are adapted to higher temperatures. First of all, the southern high bush or the northern high bush hybrids that have been chosen for that purpose. We're also watering them a lot, and we're putting them in nice, rich soil and containers, or we're putting them in the ground, mulching heavily. And the pH, correcting the pH doesn't appear to be really necessary. We do see some micronutrient deficiencies on them, as we do on other plants here. But usually, those are not a big factor in yield, and they're pretty easy to correct. But again, what it comes down to is making a healthy soil environment. It's probably better than trying to add the thing that you're trying to encourage. Making a better soil environment is likely to have them grow on their own in a natural manner that's appropriate to your region.
So there's a lot of myths and there's a lot of folk tales that are very good and are very reliable and grandpa was right. But then there's a bunch that have sort of grown up that, well, you can't disprove them necessarily, but you can't prove them either. I'm thinking particularly about carrots love tomatoes.
Oh,
Beans are incompatible with onions. And
yeah.
it's like, what? So this whole companion planting thing, it sounds like maybe some of them are just garden myths, but maybe some of them might do something. So can you help us sort out which is what?
Yeah, we're at the time of year where all these things are coming up. Your neighbor who always adds the, I like to use the Tums tablet because I just think that's funny. But I saw a recent video someone sent me where she was adding sugar to the planting hole for tomatoes to quote make them sweeter, et cetera, et cetera. Many of these things you can just disregard because if you know anything about plant physiology or soil science, you'll just go, okay, another wacky idea. But does it hurt? Probably not. That'll be one confused gopher when it hits that cup of sugar. And beyond that, it probably doesn't do anything one way or another. But companion planting is something that makes the rounds on social media every so often and has been given what you might call legitimacy by, well, Rodale Press, the organic farming folks, organic gardening folks, and a lot of permaculture folks seem to like it. The problem is that we aren't talking all about the same thing when we're talking about companion planting. The book that you mentioned is called Carrots Love Tomatoes. Well, first of all, can we ascribe that affection to a plant? I mean, I know that some of my plants appreciate me, but I don't think they love me. So,
Well, you understand when you say carrots love something, it means that that's a beneficial thing.
right.
That
And
doesn't mean that they're having an emotional reaction.
wait, all these begonias sitting next to me are not trying to tell me something?
Tomatoes love water. That's an accurate statement. They benefit when you water them.
So the examples are carrots love tomatoes, but beans are supposedly incompatible with onions and so on. This is mostly traditional lore, and you'll see it in the Old Farmer's Almanac, which a lot of people swear by. But a lot of this comes from, I'll just describe it. In the early 20th century, much was made of the sensitive crystallization chromatography tests to determine whether plants were compatible. And that is the origin of most of the complicated charts that you find online. I hope I'm pronouncing his name right, Aaron Freed Pfeiffer, who was a disciple of Rudolf Steiner. He was a chemist, not a plant person. He invented two, and I'm just reading this, anthroposophic image forming methods, a method which used a round filter chromatography, circular chromatography or chromat test, and copper chloride crystallization method. Sounds complicated. In the latter method, a solution of copper chloride in the test solution is allowed to evaporate from a bunch of juices from the plant. The pattern of the crystals, which spread out on the thing, can be read, quote unquote, based on the patterns of known samples. And the patterns of circular chromatographs can be read based on these samples. And this requires much practice and training to read and interpret the images. And based on that and the similarities between the chromatographic samples from one plant and another, they concluded that these told them something about the affinities of these plants to grow together or not. Can you see the problem with that leap of logic?
So let me see if I've got this right. A chromatograph is where I take a liquid which has something in it, and it goes up or out. In this case, it's circular, so it would go out a certain distance depending upon how soluble and how light that stuff inside is it. So if you looked at a chromatograph and it went bars that went up a certain way or out a certain way or went further, you could tell that the stuff in it was different by how far it out it went, and sometimes even what color it is. Okay, I got that part. So I can say, okay, so this plant has this amount of this kind of chlorophyll because it went that far. And this other plant has this same amount of that kind of chlorophyll, it went that far, but it doesn't tell me anything about what the chlorophyll in the plant is doing. It's got chlorophyll, it's got the same thing in it, but why would you conclude that the two things should grow together? I mean, that's like saying you've got a nose and I've got a nose, so we must be related.
Right. We are related in the broader scheme of things, but not as closely related. And I'll just be simple about it. There's no evidence whatsoever for the conclusions that they drew from crystal chromatography, supposed relations that are presented in the form of these complex charts. I will go out on a limb once again. I'm doing that a lot today. As with astrology, no offense to those of you that follow astrology, much of the evidence for companion planting seems to arise just from the complexity of the model and these elaborate charts. It gives the impression of serious inquiry, the impression of serious research. In fact, it's just complicated. It's just because something is complicated doesn't mean that it's true. So if you're seeing those charts, and they're fun, there's some really cool ones out there that you can see online. People share them. Oh, you need to know this. First of all, take a little time to look at them and you'll find some internal contradictions in them. Secondly, they have no evidentiary basis whatsoever. Okay, but I will say this, folks who are into permaculture and some of the other aspects of alternate agriculture have done research on other things they call companion planting. And so if you say, oh, companion planting doesn't work, they'll say, well, what about the three sisters? So, well, that's three plants, where you're planting the squash and the tomato and the beans together. Those are things where they have specific known benefits to each other. Okay, so the
Squash, corn and beans, Don, not tomatoes.
thank you.
Squash, corn and beans.
Yes, thank you. Okay. So, for example, the beans make nitrogen, the corn benefits from that, the squash shades the roots, and so forth. I mean, they do have some benefits for that particular climate they come from, and people have had fun planting by the Three Sisters method. That's a form of planting things as companions, but it isn't based on anything related to crystal chromatography. But there are examples of companion planting, if you're going to broaden the term, to trap cropping, where you plant something to draw pests away from a main crop. The folks in permaculture like to do this. They call it perimeter trap cropping, where they plant things like buckwheat or dill or cabbages next to their main crop to draw the pests away from one to the other. And there's some evidence that that works in very specific situations. The planting of strong smelling herbs next to your other plants may have some effect camouflaging the smell of the main crops and protecting them in some ways. Planting herbs around a garden is always a good idea anyway. It draws beneficials, possible pollinators. There might be some benefits from the release of those volatile organic compounds, but at least just having those flowers there is certainly beneficial for drawing the things that are good in your garden. Planting beneficial habitats. Okay, well, that's not really companion planting. That's just more like ecological planting. But probably the best known one is the least understood, which is the one that everybody knows, which is planting marigolds next to your tomatoes to, quote, repel pests, end quote. And we have gotten to the point where we just take flats of marigolds and we set them next to the tomatoes because it saves us trouble. When we're at our garden center, they're over there, they're flowering. I'll hear the dad telling his, little 10-year-old, we're doing these to help keep the pests away. And I'm not going to tell dad he's wrong. I don't want to interrupt his position of authority. But they don't understand where that all comes from.
Isn't this the case where there was some scientific research done, and then when it was popularized, it was expanded to include things that it never did? Isn't this in one of those cases?
Yeah, it exactly is it. The marigolds are known through direct research to suppress or kill, in some cases, certain nematodes. Nematodes are soil-borne.
Certain marigolds, not all marigolds.
Certain marigolds and certain nematodes. And it happens that the root knot nematode can be suppressed or managed to some degree by planting marigolds in soil that contains that nematode. This is morphed into, if you plant a marigold next to your tomato plant, the bugs won't eat the tomato plant. The standard joke is no, they'll eat the marigold. If you've ever grown marigolds, you know earwigs like them, snails like them, slugs like them, spider mites like them, thrips like them. So clearly they're not repelling their own pests. What they do is they put a certain types of marigolds do put a toxin in the soil that kills root knot nematode in the case of one marigold and other nematodes in the case of other marigolds. If you plant the whole bed just in marigolds, putting a marigold next to a tomato plant will do literally nothing. The tomatoes roots will be 4 feet deep and 4 feet out, and the plant will be 6 feet tall, and the marigold will grow a foot or two and have roots that are maybe 12 inches by 12 inches. So clearly, its roots are not going to have a significant percentage impact on the distribution of the roots of the tomato. It has been used as a technique where there's root knot nematode to take particular marigolds, and there are even some that have been bred for this purpose that you can find, plant the whole bed in that marigold for the whole season. And the advantage of that is, one, it removes the host plants. So just right there, you're giving some level of control of the nematodes because they don't have any host plant to glom onto. And this actually does kill them directly as well. So using it as an alternate crop, not an intercrop, but an alternate crop to manage nematodes. They're not putting a marigold in your flower garden. My father always did it. I always do it. Not because I think it's going to repel anything, but because it's a flower. And having flowers out next to your vegetables is not only pretty, but beneficial. I use cosmos more often than marigolds for the same reason. It draws in beneficials and bees and butterflies and hummingbirds and all those good things. And it helps to create a healthy ecology.
And it looks good.
Yeah, it's pretty. I mean, my dad did a row of marigolds next to his tomatoes. And so I think that's why a lot of people do it. You learn it from your father. And this goes way, way, way back on the understanding about the nematode suppression. So that, I think, is the beginning of all of this information. Now, I did see an interesting study that a marigold sitting next to a tomato plant in a greenhouse in the UK did reduce the infestation of whitefly on the tomato that was right next to the marigold, the part of the tomato that. Well, that's the first, that was my immediate reaction. Yes, they obviously just went to the marigold because they really get whiteflies in a greenhouse. But apparently, the volatile organic compounds may have had some effect. This could not be replicated in the field. So here's the thing about volatile organic compounds, or VOCs as we say them. They're volatile, they drift. So for a marigold to be putting out some sort of protective invisible cloak around the plant nearby would assume that you have no air movement for it to do any, make any difference. Yes, plants do have very important volatile organic compounds. Some plants are well known to emit them in response to stress or when they're attacked by entomoph by plant-eating insects, for example. They are well known for putting those out. There's a lot of people who like to make the leap that they're communicating with each other. You know, the other plants nearby will somehow get the message that they're under attack. It does affect them that way, but it does not protect the host plant, your desire, it's not the host plant, your crop plant in the way that most people think it does. Nothing wrong with planting marigolds in your garden, but there's also nothing wrong with substituting zinnias or cosmos if you prefer. I like to plant daisies out there, and those are all types of daisies because they draw beneficials, and that's the main reason for them. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.